Welcome to Base by Base, the papercast that brings genomics to you wherever you are. Today, we're taking a deep dive into something really fundamental: the very origins of animal life, viewed through the lens of our genomes. You think about the complexity, right? A fly, a human, even a simple sponge, it's all encoded in DNA. But how does that molecule organize all that complexity? We know that in complex animals like us, genes often have control switches, enhancers, that can be miles away on the DNA strand, millions of bases sometimes. How do they possibly connect with the gene's on switch, the promoter? The DNA can't just be lying straight. It must fold up somehow.
Exactly. That's the core idea. We're talking about the 3D architecture of chromatin. That's the DNA packaged with proteins. This folding is absolutely critical. It creates what we call chromatin loops. And these loops physically bring those distant enhancers right next to their target promoters.
Okay.
And without that physical connection, you just don't get the sophisticated gene control needed to build, you know, different kinds of cells, complex tissues, the works.
So we know modern animals do this. Humans, fruit flies, the usual suspects in the lab. But this whole system, this intricate 3D folding, when did that first appear? Did the very first, maybe simplest animal ancestors already have these rules? Or did it come later?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it?
If we can find the sort of genomic fossil record for these loops, it could tell us a lot about how animal complexity itself arose.
And that's precisely the focus for today. We're looking at some really groundbreaking work synthesized in a spotlight review, highlighting research led by Kim et al. They went way back, not just modern animals, but deep into the evolutionary tree. Yeah, their findings, which were published in Nature back in 2025, they really made us rethink the timeline of how this 3D genome organization evolved. It's a huge step forward.
Okay, so before we dive into their new results, maybe let's just quickly set the scene. What was the sort of established view? When people looked at complex organisms, what were the main levels of 3D structure they saw?
Right. So the textbook picture was kind of hierarchical. At the very broad scale, you have these things called AB compartments. Think of them as huge neighborhoods in the genome. A compartments are generally active, lots of genes turned on. B compartments are typically silent, repressed.
Okay, big active and inactive zones.
Exactly. And then zooming in, you get the more functional structures. These are TADs, topologically associating domains. They're like insulated loops or domains. And nested within or formed by these TADs are the specific chromatin loops we talked about, the ones connecting enhancers and promoters.
Right.
And for a long time, the consensus was really that this fine-tuned distal regulation using these loops and TADs was a key innovation that kind of defined animals, metazoans.
And in animals like us, bilaterians, the machinery often involves proteins like CTCF and cohesin, right?
Sure.
Doing something called loop extrusion?
Yes, that's the model. They sort of school the DNA out, creating these insulated packages. So the Kim team was essentially asking, was this whole system, or even just parts of it, present right at the dawn of animal life?
So who did they look at to answer this? You can't just look at humans and flies.
No, definitely not. They had to be really systematic. They looked at the closest living relatives of animals that are still single-celled. That includes groups like ichthyosporians, philisterians, and choanoflagellates.
The sister groups?
Precisely. And then, crucially, they examined the earliest branching animal lineages themselves. We're talking sponges, trinophores, comb jellies, placozoans, and cnidarians, like jellyfish and corals. These groups represent really critical branching points on the tree of life. They're our best window into what the ancestral animal genome might have looked like.
Now, mapping this 3D structure, that sounds tricky, especially in these organisms. Don't some of them have really small genomes compared to us?
They do, yeah. Sometimes surprisingly compact, down to maybe 50 or 90 million bases. And you're right, traditional methods, like the standard Hi-C technique, can struggle to get really high resolution at that scale.
So what was the key technique they used?
They use something called micro-C. It stands for micrococcal nucleus proximity ligation. It's a bit of a mouthful, but the difference is important.
Okay.
You mentioned Hi-C. It uses restriction enzymes, which cut DNA only at specific sequence patterns. Those patterns aren't evenly spread, so you get gaps, lower resolution in places.
Right, makes sense.
Micro-C avoids that. It uses an enzyme, micrococcal nucleus, that cuts DNA between nucleosomes. Nucleosomes are the basic units of DNA packaging, the little spools of DNA wrapped around histone proteins. So micro-C cuts are dictated by the physical structure of chromatin itself, not just the sequence. This gives much more even, reproducible fragmentation, and ultimately much higher resolution.
Ah, I see. So they could actually see the fine details, even in those small genomes. Okay, let's get to the findings. What about those big AB compartments first? When do they show up?
Okay, so the AB-like compartments. The evidence suggests these are generally a metazoan, an animal invention. They consistently found them in the animals, but not in any of the unicellular relatives they looked at.
Wow. So that ability to just globally divide the genome into active and inactive territories seems to have emerged right around the origin of animals.
That seems to be the case. Although, like always in biology, there was an interesting wrinkle. Cetacephores, the comb jellies, also clearly showed AB compartments.
Okay, noted. But let's get to the main event, those specific regulatory loops, the enhancer promoter handshakes. Where did they first appear on the scene?
This was, I think, the clearest finding. These regulatory chromatin loops were essentially absent outside of metazoans.
Really? None in the single-celled relative?
None that they could reliably detect. But importantly, they did find them in most of the early branching animals they studied, cnidarians, ctenophores, and placozoans.
So this is really the headline finding, isn't it? These functional loops are likely ancestral to all animals. They weren't a later add-on. They seem to have been part of the toolkit from the very beginning.
That's the major conclusion, yes. It fundamentally changes how we think about the genomic basis of early animal evolution.
But you said they found loops in most early animals. And were the loops they found structured the same way as ours, with those insulated tads we talked about?
Ah, good questions. No, the architecture wasn't uniform, and it wasn't quite like the typical bilaterian picture. What they found were loops that were more localized. They do the job, they connect regulatory elements, but they generally aren't organized into those large insulated tads formed by loop extrusion, the CTCF-based system we see in mammals.
So a different flavor of organization.
Exactly. It suggests maybe a more modular, perhaps gene-by-gene or region-by-region control system was operating early on, rather than the large domain structure.
And within that early diversity, you mentioned placozoans and ctenophores had some really unique features. Let's start with placozoans, these weird, flat, simple animals, only six cell types, tiny genome. What did they find there?
Placozoans were fascinating. They showed something the researchers called promoter hubs.
Promoter hubs?
Yeah, instead of just one enhancer looping to one promoter, like hundreds of promoter start sites, potentially from many different genes, were all physically clustering together in 3D space.
Hundreds? Why would they do that?
Well, think about it. Placozoans are simple, only a few cell types. This could be a really efficient way to co-regulate large sets of genes. Maybe genes that need to be on in all cells, like housekeeping genes, just gather all their on switches together in one place for easy access. It's a genomic solution we don't really see or haven't focused on in animals with more complex TAD structures.
Interesting. A different strategy entirely. Okay, what about the ctenophores, the comb jellies? They often sit in a controversial spot on the tree of life, sometimes placed as the very first branch. Did they also have a unique looping mechanism?
They absolutely did, and this was a really neat piece of detective work. The authors identified two specific proteins, C2H2 zinc finger proteins, that seem to be doing the job in ctenophores. Now, these proteins belong to the same broad family as the CTCF factor used in bilaterians, but they are distinct.
So related, but different.
Exactly. And crucially, these ctenophore-specific factors bind to specific DNA sequences, unmethylated sequences, actually, and these binding sites mark the anchor points of the chromatin loops found in ctenophores. What this means is that ctenophores didn't just borrow the system from other animals, they appear to have independently evolved their own specific molecular toolkit to create and control chromatin loops.
Wow. Okay, so the big picture emerging is the ability to form regulatory loops is ancient. Likely ancestral to all animals. But the way those loops are formed, the specific proteins and mechanisms involved, diversified really early on.
That's the core of the argument for independent evolution, yes. Cnidarians, cnidars, placozoans, they likely developed parallel, distinct genomic strategies to achieve spatial gene regulation. They aren't just steps on a ladder leading to us, they represent different successful evolutionary paths that emerged very early.
But if loops are ancestral, we have to address the elephant, or maybe the sponge, in the room. You mentioned sponges porifera. They are animals. They have different cell types, comparable to placozoans in some ways. Mm-hmm. But the researchers didn't find clear loops in them.
Correct. That's the sponge puzzle, and it's a major point of discussion. If loops are ancestral to metazoa, why don't sponges seem to have them, or at least not in an easily detectable way using these methods?
So what are the possibilities?
Well, there are two main interpretations, and they have pretty big implications. First, the more traditional view is maybe sponges represent the actual ancestral state for animals.
Meaning loops only evolved after sponges split off.
Yeah.
In the lineage leading to eumetazoans, everything else.
That's one possibility. It would mean loops aren't ancestral to all metazoa, but rather to eumetazoa.
Okay, what's the alternative?
The alternative hinges on that controversial phylogeny where ctenophores are the sister group to all other animals. Okay. If ctenophores branched off first and they have loops,
then loops were ancestral and sponges must have lost them later.
That's exactly. Secondary loss. Which then raises a whole new question. Why would a lineage lose such a seemingly fundamental mechanism for gene regulation? We don't have the answer yet. It's a really active area of debate.
Definitely something to keep an eye on. But moving beyond the origins, another really significant finding, I thought, was how this challenges the idea that all this 3D structure is just about managing genome size.
Yes, the function over size point.
Great.
There was this hypothesis floating around that, you know, as genomes got bigger and enhancers got further away from genes, you needed things like TADs and loops just to keep everything organized and prevent miswiring.
Like managing a bigger city requires more complex zoning.
Sort of, yeah. But this study really throws cold water on that idea being the primary driver. They pointed to a specific comparison. They looked at a unicellular relative, an ichthyosporian, which has a relatively large genome for a microbe, about 140 million bases, and it completely lacks these regulatory loops.
Okay.
But then you have the placozoan with its tiny 90 million base genome, and it's packed with those promoter hubs, a form of 3D organization.
So bigger genome, no loops, smaller genome, complex 3D structure.
Precisely. It strongly suggests that this 3D architecture isn't just about coping with size. It's fundamentally about enabling complex gene regulation, regardless of how big or small the genome is. Function seems to be the main driver.
That really changes how you think about genome structure, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It implies there might be much more diversity in how genomes are organized, even in well-studied animals, than we currently appreciate.
I think that's a major implication. The authors themselves point out that even a well-known factor like CTCF doesn't work exactly the same way in vertebrates compared to fruit flies. This work serves as a bit of a wake-up call, suggesting we should be looking for more diversity in control factors and mechanisms. There could be lineage-specific or even tissue-specific ways of organizing chromatin that we're completely missing because we're focused on the universal players.
We might be overlooking specialized local architects while focusing on the main construction company.
That's a good analogy, yeah.
Okay, so let's try to wrap this up. If you're listening, the key insight from this deep dive is really this. The 3D architecture needed for complex animal life, particularly those regulatory loops connecting enhancers and promoters, seems to be a very ancient feature. It likely appeared right at the dawn of animal evolution. But importantly, this ability didn't evolve as one single system. The mechanisms controlling these loops diversified extremely early and, it seems, independently. We see clear evidence of different strategies in lineages like ctenophores and placozoans. And this leaves us with a really interesting question to ponder. If the basic rules for making these critical loops could diversify so radically way back then, what does that mean for complexity now? Could there be unrecognized, maybe tissue-specific architectural control systems at work in, say, different human cell types that we've overlooked because they aren't universal? What hidden layers of genomic control are still waiting to be discovered?
This episode was based on an open access article under the CCB Y 4.0 license. You can find a direct link to the paper and the license in our episode description. If you enjoyed this, follow or subscribe in your podcast app and leave a 5-star rating. If you'd like to support our work, use the donation link in the description. Thanks for listening and join us next time as we explore more science, base by base.